KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Jupiter Hotel, a mid-century Portland Motor Inn-turned hotel located at 800 East Burnside Street, less than 1 mile from the Convention and Moda Centers, and Jupiter Next, a 67-room independent boutique hotel. Booking and more information is available online at jupiterhotel.com. Stay tuned for your 5 o'clock news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Dost movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Dost is a documentary about a young lady who uses psychedelic therapy to overcome her addiction to heroin. After the show, there will be a panel discussion featuring members of the cast and production. They will be taking questions from the audience. Again, that's the Dost movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Bureau of Transportation voices opposition to the proposed Rose Quarter I-5 expansion.
The Jordan Cove natural gas pipeline permit in Coos Bay has been withdrawn.
And we take a look at what happened today in impeachment.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 24th, 2020. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Claire Machado. The controversial Rose Quarter expansion of I-5 is facing pushback from a new group, the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Yesterday, PBOT disagreed with revisions to the project, which could cut neighborhood improvements in a historically disenfranchised area. The Rose Quarter Improvement Project is led by the Oregon Department of Transportation, with the City of Portland as a partner. It seeks to add merging and shoulder lanes to a portion of I-5 in order to ease congestions between I-84 and I-405. The project also originally proposed adding a new bicycle and pedestrian bridge, and two covers over the freeway to provide more public spaces. Recent reports say that the highway covers may be cut due to budget concerns, and a state report estimated that the project's price tag has risen from $450 million to over $700 million. Including highway covers could give the project a billion-dollar price tag. Community groups have pushed back against the project, arguing that a freeway expansion would negatively affect the environment and the surrounding neighborhoods, including Harriet Tubman Middle School. PBOT tweeted yesterday that the project must acknowledge the harms from the past and work with the community, citing the 1950s displacement of Black communities when I-5 was first constructed. Despite pushback, ODOT hopes to begin construction in 2023 and anticipates 4 to 5 years to complete the project.
The Jordan Cove Energy Project withdrew its application for a key permit from the state of Oregon effective today. Earlier this week, the Oregon Department of State Lands denied a fifth deadline extension request for the application to Pembina Pipeline, the Canadian company behind the Jordan Cove project. Pembina was hoping to build a 229-mile-long pipeline to a new natural gas export terminal in Coos Bay on Oregon's south coast. The denied application was for a removal fill permit, a necessary approval that would allow the company to remove sands and sediment in Coos Bay and anywhere else the proposed pipeline would cross rivers and wetlands. The removal would allow massive ships to transport liquefied natural gas from Jordan Cove to foreign markets around the world. The $10 billion Jordan Cove pipeline project, proposed some 10 years ago, has been heavily criticized by environmentalists and the many landowners who would be affected by the project, yielding nearly 50,000 comments to the state. In a four-page letter to Pembina, Oregon State Lands Director Vicki Walker detailed the number of ways Pembina's application was deficient and declined to give the company an additional time to complete it. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, however, or FERC, is expected to make a final decision on the project next month. If FERC greenlights the project, the company may argue that federal law overrides Oregon state law, which could lead the case to the courts.
An early Friday morning landslide is responsible for blocking lanes of West Burnside near Northwest Barnes Road. PBOT closed both directions of the road between Skyline and Barnes to clean up debris from the slide, with marked detour signs rerouting morning traffic. The road closure will likely last the entirety of Friday, as officials report it to be the largest landslide to block a city street in years. 2 years ago, a small landslide occurred nearby, resulting in the addition of a retaining wall at the location. Following today's incident, travel officials are urging motorists to observe flaggers and warning signs, as the hillside area remains unpredictable. Recent heavy rainfall is likely the trigger to Friday's slide, as large amounts of rain following minimal precipitation can cause sudden disruption in soil. Due to poor drainage, homeowners residing in the area have been advised to make sure of proper water drainage and to keep storm drains clear and ensure there are no broken pipes as landslide season continues to unfold.
A new poll suggests voters in Oregon support political consequences for state senators who stage a walkout like the one that blocked a carbon cap bill in the 2019 legislative session. The poll was paid for by a group of the state's public sector unions, and of the 750 people polled, it shows 65% would support removing a state legislator from office if they, quote, didn't show up for the job, end quote. Senate Republicans fled the state to prevent a vote on the proposed climate change measure in 2019. Democratic state senators will be bringing a serious policy agenda to the 35-day legislative short session that begins in February, which will again include climate change policy. But Senate Republicans have indicated that another walkout is not out of the question. The upcoming agenda will also include stricter gun control laws, earthquake preparedness policy changes, allocating money towards the state's housing crisis, and changing the ways wildfires are fought throughout the state.
Today marks the fifth day of the trial of President Trump in the U.S. Senate. Today, the impeachment managers, led by top House Democrats, are concluding their 24 hours of opening statements. For the first time in history, witnesses are being prevented from testifying at an impeachment trial. Also, for the first time in history, the president who is on trial is refusing to testify. The House impeachment manager, California Representative Adam Schiff, said in his statement this morning that the very foundation of democracy is at stake.
Now, I have no doubt that the Russians and probably every other nation that has the capacity does a psychological profile of the President of the United States, as we profile other leaders. If a president can be so easily manipulated to disbelieve his own intelligence agencies, to accept the propaganda of the Kremlin, that is a threat to our national security. And that is just what has happened here. But that's not all. President Trump's willingness to entangle our foreign allies in a corrupt political errand also undermined the credibility of Americans to promote the rule of law and fight corruption abroad. This is Trump first, not American first, not American ideals first. And the result has and will continue to be grave harm to our nation if this chamber does not stand up and say it is wrong. If you do not stand up and say this is not only wrong, not only unacceptable, but conduct incompatible with the office of the presidency.
Representative Val Demings of Florida talked about the precedent that would be set if the president were allowed to get away with criminal charges.
It would inflict irreversible damage by allowing this commander-in-chief and establishing precedents for future presidents to act corruptly or abusively and then use the vast powers of their office, the office of the presidency, to conceal their own misconduct from Congress and the American people. In other words, we would create a system that allows this president and any future president to really do whatever he or she wants. It is an attack on congressional oversight, not just on the House, but also on the Senate's own ability to oversee and serve as a check on this and future presidents, both Republican and Democratic administrations. Without meaningful oversight, without the power of impeachment, Americans will have to come to accept a far greater likelihood of misconduct in the Oval Office, and they would not be able to look to other branches of government to hold their president, the people's president, accountable. Executive power without any sort of restraint, without oversight, and without any checks and balances is absolute power. And we know what has been said about absolute power. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
In New York, Representative Gerald Nadler talked about the historical cases of impeachment and how no other president in history has refused to cooperate in an impeachment investigation because to do so severely undermines the separation of powers laid out in the Constitution.
Although the power of the congressional subpoena has been affirmed repeatedly by the courts, enshrined in the rules of the House and Senate, and respected by executive branch agencies for centuries, if the president chooses to ignore our subpoenas, our power as a branch of government, our ability to do our jobs, our ability to keep an administration in check, our ability to make sure that the American people are represented by a Congress and not just by a president is diminished. Please know that we are not talking about a disagreement over the last few documents at the end of a long production schedule. We are talking about a direct order from the President of the United States to completely disregard all our subpoenas, to deny us all information the President wants to keep secret. This is in order to deprive Congress of our ability to hold an administration accountable. It is a bid to neuter Congress, to render the President all-powerful, since Congress could not have any information the President didn't want us to have. Without information, we cannot act. And so we must ask, is there a consequence for a President who defies our subpoenas absolutely, who says to all branches of the administration, do not obey a single congressional subpoena categorically without knowing the subject of the subpoena? Just never answer a congressional subpoena? Who denies Congress the right to any information necessary to challenge his power? Would Madison, Hamilton, and Washington support removing a president who declares that the Constitution lets him do whatever he wants and who brazenly adds that he can ignore any effort to investigate, even when backed by subpoenas that the law requires him to obey? The answer to all these questions is a resounding yes. But before diving in, I'd like to set the historical scene. The framers were wise, and so they worried that presidents would abuse their power for personal gain. They feared that someday a president might mistake himself for a king, whose decisions cannot be questioned, whose conduct cannot be investigated, whose power transcends the rule of law. Such a would-be king would certainly think things like, quote, I have the right to do whatever I want as president. He might believe that it is, quote, illegitimate for anyone to investigate him. Of course, not even the framers could have imagined that a president would say these things out loud. A president with this view of raw power would attack anyone who tried to hold him to account, branding them, quote, human scum, and, quote, the enemy of the people. He would argue that courts have no power to enforce subpoenas against him. He would conscript his allies to ridicule Congress. He would harass witnesses who testified against him, declaring it disloyal to question his conduct. He would use the powers of his eye office to sabotage our system of checks and balances. All of this we have seen in the last few years, indeed in the last few months. The framers wrote the impeachment clause to protect the American people from such a president. The impeachment clause exists to protect our freedom and our democracy in between elections. It exists to remind presidents that they serve the public, not the other way around. It is a reminder to presidents that they answer to something greater than themselves. It confirms that nobody in America is above the law, not even the president. But as we have discussed, the impeachment power does not magically protect us when the president commits high crimes and misdemeanors. In Benjamin Franklin's words, the framers left us a republic, if we can keep it. Now, one way we can uphold that promise is to do our duty as elected members of Congress to hold the executive branch in check. That responsibility is part of the constitutional design. The burden is ours, regardless of our political party, no matter who sits in the Oval Office.
That was New York Representative Jerry Nadler speaking in the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Democrats appear to be using their 24 hours of opening arguments to try to convince a small group of Senate Republicans to cross the aisle and vote with them to issue subpoenas for documents and witnesses. If four Republicans decide to cross party lines and vote to subpoena witnesses and view evidence, the witnesses and evidence will be allowed. Meanwhile, the House Intelligence Committee is not taking action on new evidence and witnesses that have emerged, although they could continue their investigation parallel to the Senate trial. Today, ABC News presented an additional piece of evidence, a recording of Donald Trump and Lev Parnas, in which Trump says of U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, quote, "I want her out. Take her out." Trump had previously claimed he didn't even know Lev Parnas. Full coverage of the president's trial for corruption and abuse of power is found on C-SPAN.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 46. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a light rain later in the day and a high of 54 degrees. Today in history, in 1993, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall died. He was the court's first black justice, and prior to that appointment, he argued several important cases before the Supreme Court, including Brown versus the Board of Education, which held that racial segregation in public education is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. The quote of the day is from Marshall, who said, quote, "In recognizing the humanity of our fellow beings, we pay ourselves the highest tribute." And
Bellingham, Washington has made national headlines recently over a proposal to ban residential use of natural gas in its quest to become carbon neutral by 2035. But proponents of the plan say misinformation abounds on what the city's trying to do. Eric Tagetoff has more.
Dr. Charles Barnhart, who was part of the Bellingham Climate Action Task Force, notes it isn't the first city to move in this direction. Berkeley, California, for example, banned the potent greenhouse gas in new buildings last year. Barnhart says the task force took it a step further and suggested natural gas furnaces and burners be replaced with electric heat pumps when it's time for new equipment.
The other thing that I feel that some citizens of Bellingham are getting upset about is they think it's happening tomorrow. It's not. It's 2035. It's 15 years from now. And so chances are boilers or heat pumps will need replacement at that stage anyways.
The proposal hasn't been formally introduced to the city council. Opponents say there'd be a hefty price tag for swapping out equipment. Barnhart believes there are ways to mitigate expenses given the lower energy costs of electric heat pumps. The Northwest Gas Association says it will spend $1 million in the region to promote natural gas benefits. Imran Sheikh, who teaches environmental science at Western Washington University, helped the task force research getting carbon out of the residential sector, an important factor in curbing climate change. Sheikh says the proposal is achievable.
Right now, the city is facing that challenge and looking at a few different strategies to do that. I think it is certainly attainable, it's technically possible. Whether it's politically feasible is to be determined.
Matt Krogh is with Stand.Earth, a group that launched the Standing Against Fossil Fuel Expansion, or Safe Cities, program. While they might employ similar tactics, he says each community will have to map out its own path to clean energy.
That process is going to be undermined every step of the way by the fossil fuel interests. And it's really important that we keep our eye on the prize, which is clean energy, and not get sucked back into this sort of dirty energy economy.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
U.S. health officials confirmed on Friday that a second patient had been diagnosed with the coronavirus responsible for the deaths of at least 26 people in China. The patient is a Chicago-area woman who recently visited Wuhan in the Hubei province of China, where the virus was first discovered. The new patient is in her 60s and is in stable condition. 62 other cases over 22 states are being monitored, including the first patient in Washington state, and the virus has been detected in France, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Nepal. The Center for Disease Control believes, quote, "The immediate risk to the U.S. public is low at this time, but the situation continues to evolve rapidly," end quote, stating that there are likely to be more cases in the coming days. The flu-like coronavirus, first identified on December 31st, has killed at least 26 people and has been confirmed in over 800 cases. 33 million people in China are under travel restrictions this weekend in an attempt to keep the virus from spreading further.
The doomsday clock has moved to 100 seconds to midnight, the closest to midnight the clock has ever seen. The clock was started in 1947 to warn of the dangers of nuclear war, but the move this year was intended to indicate the dire nature that climate change poses to Earth. As president of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Rachel Bronson, said on Thursday, quote, "We now face a true emergency, an absolutely unacceptable state of world affairs that has eliminated any margin for error or further delay," end quote. The decision was made to move the clock closer to the zero hour based on the two threats of nuclear war and climate change, compounded by the rise of false information online and the insistent refusal of world leaders to act on critical issues. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was founded by scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project to develop the first nuclear bomb, and today has 13 Nobel laureates on its board. The clock is used to determine how close humanity is to annihilation each year. Though the clock is a, quote, "striking metaphor for the precarious state of the world," it's a metaphor backed by rigorous scientific scrutiny.
At least 14 people died and hundreds of others were injured in a 6.8 magnitude earthquake in eastern Turkey today. The large quake was also felt in the neighboring states of Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. The region struck by the earthquake is about 340 miles east of the capital city of Ankara and is remote and sparsely populated, meaning details of damage and fatalities may be slow to emerge. Officials have sent beds, tents, and blankets to the area where overnight temperatures regularly fall below zero. In 1999, a 7.6 magnitude earthquake killed over 17,000 people in western Turkey, and a 7.1 earthquake in 2011 killed over 500 people in the eastern city of Van.
A federal court is considering challenges to a four-decades-old law put in place to protect Native American children against state-led efforts to break up families. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Judges at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments this week on the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, which gives tribes jurisdiction over children in custody, adoption, and foster care cases. Challengers include three non-Native families looking to adopt Native children, who argue the law is unconstitutionally race-based. Lillian Alvarez with the ACLU of Montana says forced family separation has an ugly past. She says she felt privileged to grow up in her Dakota and Nakota culture.
It has a really positive impact in children. There are several studies demonstrating the connection of what culture can do for a child. For example, increased graduation rates, less likely to become incarcerated.
The Brackeen versus Bernhardt case challenges past Supreme Court decisions that said being Native American is a political rather than a racial classification. Alvarez says the law is important to Native Americans.
Doing away with ICWA or challenging federal Indian law in general can only have negative and detrimental impacts to Indian people and especially Indian children.
Alvarez also notes ICWA is carried out by state courts. Montana and 21 other states have signed on to the case in support of the law, while 4 states have joined the case against it. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And now, 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
We're grassroots people, and we've been on the ground.
Tom Steyer's a billionaire and an activist. He founded Next Gen America in 2013 to get young people involved in politics and registered to vote. And he's been working the campaign trail hard. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is the other Democratic primary billionaire. He spent $248 million on radio, TV, and digital ads, according to Politico, over $100 million more than Steyer. And each has spent far more than all the other Democratic hopefuls combined. Other candidates, and voters too, worry about the impact of big money on elections.
I watched the news this morning. There was like 10 commercials, political commercials, none of them paid for by somebody running for president, paid for by somebody else.
Iowan Roger Brown posed a question to Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren when she was in Iowa last week.
So these companies and these people who are influencing are a little bit of information that we're going to get to make a decision on you today, have the money to put in there to give me doubt about you. So how do you change that process so the money stops trying to influence my perception of you?
Warren's response.
The one thing that beats a TV ad, the one thing that beats a Facebook ad, the one thing that beats fake news is you. It's you. It's the face-to-face. It's the handshake.
But 4 candidates are stuck in D.C. for the Senate impeachment trial and can't shake hands or come face-to-face with voters.
If the only way you can get to be the Democratic nominee for President of the United States is either be a billionaire or suck up to billionaires, then watch out, because we're going to have an America that works better and better for billionaires and worse for everyone else.
Bloomberg isn't accepting any contributions from potential voters. The Center for Responsive Politics, Brandon Quinn, has a warning.
It's very rare that a candidate who almost completely self-funds their campaign finds success, because they're not really interacting with the base that would be their donors and also their voters.
Quinn says Steyer's model, self-funding combined with outside fundraising, can work. Last cycle, President Trump contributed $66 million of his own money to his total of over $300 million. It's showing in South Carolina, where Steyer's in second place. After spending around $12 million on TV ads, he's putting in the FaceTime to try and make it stick.
We have a lot of momentum right now. You know, the polls have been getting a lot better in the early states. More people show up, and then people hear that the numbers are going up, and so they realize, oh my God, this guy can really win.
Steyer and other candidates not in the Senate are showing up in Iowa, where Andrew Yang is set to appear today with former candidate Marianne Williamson. She's not officially endorsing Yang, but she wants to help him get through the early primaries. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Forget roaming bears. What about 2 elephants gallivanting about your city streets? That was the case for residents of Yekaterinburg, Russia's third largest city, following the animals' escape from a nearby circus Thursday afternoon. In town celebrating the new year, Carla and Ranny escaped the Italian circus troupe they were traveling with to romp and roll in the city's snow. After multiple failed attempts by citizens and over a dozen crew members in tow, the animals were persuaded to return to their confines. The circus was loading up and preparing for departure when the 2 elephants escaped. Circus spokespeople said wistfully that they just wanted to get in some sightseeing before the long journey onward.
High school graduation rates in Portland public schools are the highest they've been in a decade. Seniors last year graduated at a rate of 80%, and over the past 3 years, the Portland district has seen gains in graduation rates for students across racial groups and above the state average. School Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero attributes the success to a renewed commitment to focus on all student groups with special emphasis on historically underserved students. New strategies like a four-year cohort model adopted in 2010 and an emphasis on supporting ninth graders adopted 2 years ago help contribute to the increase in diplomas. The climbing graduation rate in Portland is representative of Oregon as a whole, with the 2018 class graduating at an all-time high.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 24th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Hannah Merzbach, Nat Moon, Jenka Soderberg, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Eric Tagadoff. Our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Clara Schotto.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Have a wonderful weekend.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. Millions of Indian people, maybe a quarter billion, have taken to the street in recent weeks. The right-wing Modi government